Welcome, everyone. Today we will start out with a public hearing on House Bill 2370. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2370A comes to you from the House Judiciary Committee, passed out of the House unanimously. It requires that the state medical examiner issues a death certificate within 45 days of receiving credible information that a person is missing at sea and presumed dead. There's basically two reasons that this bill was put forward. First, it's extremely rare for individuals who are missing at sea and presumed dead to be later found or to survive. Second, without having a death certificate, family members are unable to receive certain benefits such as Social Security payments. In the past, we heard testimony that it had taken up to 5 months to receive that death certificate from the state medical examiner. So this bill would essentially prioritize the process in these situations.
Thank you for that summary. And welcome, Representative Brown.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair. And your administrator has already given most of my testimony.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Obviously,
you.
Very good. House Bill 2370.
Representative Brown, could you identify yourself?
And that's right, I do, don't I? For the record, I'm State Representative Alan Brown from House District 10. House Bill 2370 requires the state medical examiner to issue a death certificate within 45 days of receiving credible information that a person is missing at sea and presumed dead. Commercial fishing is often referred to as the most dangerous occupation on earth, and for good reason. It seems like we lose some vessels every year. It happens far too often. If you're on one of these boats when it goes down, your chances of surviving are not good. The water temperatures are in the high 40s to low 50s, and you die of hypothermia even if you're wearing a life jacket. Most times in these boating accidents, there are no survivors, and the bodies are not recovered. It's a terrible tragedy for the crew and for their surviving families. Most always, it is the husband or the father who dies, and the family is dependent upon him for support. Without a death certificate, Social Security will not pay benefits to surviving spouse or children. Any payment from the vessel insurance can take years to resolve. And the survivors need a death certificate within a reasonable time frame. Testimony was given that it has taken as long as 5 months after receiving an official report from the Coast Guard stating that a person is missing at sea and presumed dead before a death certificate is issued. In a work session, an agreement was gained that 45 days after the receipt of these reports, and if credible, a death certificate would be issued. On behalf of the fishing families of the Oregon coast, I ask for your support in House Bill 2370. Thank you, Madam Speaker. Madam Chair.
Thank you. I sometimes get called Your Honor, but I've not been called the Speaker yet.
Thank you very much.
I had occasion to be in Newport not too long ago, and they have a kind of a promenade with all the names of the fishermen who died.
Madam Chair, up at the Yaquina Head Park up there, they have a memorial to the people that have been lost at sea. And then on the walkway down by the port, there ever so many steps, there's a name embedded in the sidewalk of someone that was lost at sea in a commercial fishing accident.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of them.
They go back to the 30s.
Yes.
Some of them go back to the 20s. So I'm glad.
Madam Chair, this bill sprung out of a fishing accident that happened 2 years ago. A fishing crab boat was going out on opening day, and that time of year, the crab season opens in December, and the Pacific Ocean generally can be very rough that time of year, but the fishermen are under a lot of pressure to get their gear out there because they need to start making some living, make some money, and put food on the table, and so they go out sometimes in weather that they probably shouldn't do, take some risks they shouldn't, and this boat, the Nasefa, was off. You went ahead with a full load of crab pots, and it rolled over, and four members of the crew were, none of the bodies were ever found. And one of the young men was Bob Edder's son, who had come home from college to work during the season on his dad's boat, and needless to say, he never went back to school.
Thank you for that story. Is there anyone else who wishes, any other questions? Senator Starr.
Got a little story of my own. August 25th of 2001, my brother Tom took three of his grown grandchildren fishing. They found the boat 30 hours later upside down on the rocks. Coast Guard searched extensively for 2 days, said they were not likely to find bodies. I intervened and the governor of Oregon intervened and they searched for one additional day. Still found no bodies. On the seventh day, fishermen found a body 70 miles north in the Straits of Juan de Fuca, floating 8 to 10 feet underwater, life preserver on. The next day, two bodies were found tied together 12 miles south of the accident scene. The three young men who died were two 19-year-olds and a 21-year-old. My brother's body was not found. And this law might have helped, though I think that they did get a quick settlement in the state of Washington. The accident occurred off the Olympic Peninsula. But this certainly would help families, and surely we should support such a law.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Are there other questions or comments from the committee? Thank you. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2370 and open a work session on House Bill 2370. Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 2370 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2370 to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr, would you like to carry this?
I'd love to carry this.
Thank you. Okay. We will now open. We'll do houses. We'll now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1034. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1034 comes to us from the Rules Committee, and it is a measure that would amend the dependency code statutes regarding foster children. What it does is it would amend the statute in order to affirmatively state that the commitment to the Department of Human Services, also known as foster care, continues until the court dismisses that commitment or until a child becomes 21 years old. The measure goes on to give the court authority to dismiss the commitment to the Department of Human Services if the child is over 14 years old, but only if the court makes findings that there is an appropriate case planning for the child's successful transition to independent living, that adequate services in that regard were offered to the child, that the agency has involved the child in the development of the case plan, and that the child has safe and stable housing and is unlikely to become homeless as a result of the dismissal of the commitment to DHS.
Okay, thank you. Did we have Hans in the audience here? The one that you wanted to testify on. Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Senator Burdick, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Hans Bernard. I'm Senator Brown's legislative assistant. I wanted to briefly talk with you this morning or this afternoon about Senate Bill 1034. As you may know, Senator Brown sat as an ex officio member on the Citizens Crime Commission Homelessness Youth Prevention Task Force, and this bill comes, I think, in some ways as a direct part of that experience. As counsel just stated, the bill will essentially let the state build a bridge for young children in our communities who are moving from foster care placement into young adulthood. It will provide the state the ability to prevent these children from becoming homeless, and as we have seen and as this report outlines, we believe that it will greatly reduce crime and also benefit these young kids immensely. So if you have any questions, I'll be happy to respond to them. Otherwise, there are much more well-versed people here who can answer expert questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions, Mr. Bernard? Thank you very much, Hans. We'll now take Maggie Miller and Julie McFarland. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Burdick, members of the committee. I'm Maggie Miller. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Crime Commission. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Citizens Crime Commission in support of Senate Bill 1034. I put a packet of the task force report that the Crime Commission published in October of 2003 at each of your place, and in that there's several articles, testimony, and support for this bill. The Crime Commission is a nonprofit organization with a board of 45 business people who advocate for a balanced public safety system that includes prevention, incarceration, and intervention. The Crime Commission brings a unique business perspective to the criminal justice system that it focuses on the greatest cost benefit for public dollars spent. To give you some background on how the Crime Commission got involved in an issue regarding homeless youth, in 1998, the Crime Commission, in conjunction with the Association for Portland Progress, formed a joint committee to address the problems related to homeless youth and the system that designed to serve them in Portland. The committee found the existing services for homeless displaced youth in Portland to be inadequate in scope, woefully underfunded, and undermined by lack of government leadership. The committee then took on the task of reorganization and recruited Multnomah County and private investors to oversee and coordinate a new system that now delivers an appropriate continuum services for this population. Unfortunately, since 1998 and prior, one main concern has continued to affect the lives of homeless youth living on the streets, not only Portland, but of our state. As stated in a report issued by the Multnomah County Ad Hoc Committee back in 1998, it stated a significant number of homeless youth are coming from the foster care system. Many of these youth are not ready for independent living. The same findings were expressed in 2001 and 2003 audits produced by the Multnomah County Auditor's Office. In response to those statements and findings, and from hearing testimony from the homeless youth providers in Portland, the Crime Commission formed another homeless youth prevention task force in October of 2003. After a year-long study, I was naive enough to think that we'd look at this in 6 months. After a year-long study, we published a report that came to the same conclusion, that many youth are leaving foster care without the tools needed to prevent them from moving from parentlessness to homelessness. As stated back in 1999 by Dr. Noel of the Oregon Research Institute on his study of adolescents in downtown Portland, he found even at that time that 38% of the youth had been in foster care before coming to the streets. Homeless youth often trade or sell sex for their basic needs. Over 90% of homeless youth have used some form of drugs or alcohol, and rates of HIV and hepatitis C infection are reportedly higher in this group. The Crime Commission strongly urges the passage of Senate Bill 1034. Though a small step, Senate 1034 will enhance Senate Bill 808 to give the judges more leverage to ensure that services have or are being provided to ensure the successful transition to self-sufficiency prior to a foster care child's case being closed by the Department of Human Services. And also, with the mission of the Crime Commission, when you look at the cost of an enhanced therapeutic foster care service for one day, it amounts to $130.99. versus the cost of a juvenile justice detention bed without alcohol and drug treatment of $215.99 a day. This is a cost-effective way to keep this population from entering the expanding and ever-expensive criminal justice system. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. And did you have prepared testimony to give to the committee?
Yes, it's all in the packets. I'm sorry. I gave everybody. It should be at your seat packet.
Okay. Got it. I was looking at the wrong
with time. Letters of support and great. Media articles. And
great. Great. And thank you for, and all of the members of the commission for your work on this issue. You, I'm from Portland. You do an amazing job in the whole justice area.
Thank you.
Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Julie McFarlane. I'm a supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project, and we have been concerned for some time about the very poor outcomes for children who are aging out of foster care, including the fact that many of them do become homeless. In the last session, statistics from a number of studies that show what those poor outcomes are, including the high levels of homelessness, unemployment, involvement in criminal activity, and mental health problems. And there is a very recent Casey Family Program study cited in my testimony of the Pacific Northwest that also presents some statistical data about those problems.
Could you speak up just a little bit? Thank you.
Sure. In the last session, the Juvenile Rights Project submitted Senate Bill 808, which the legislature passed, and that bill was designed to address some of the problems of poor outcomes for youth aging out of foster care. Basically set up a system requiring planning by DHS for individual children to develop transition plans so that they would be well prepared for the transition to adulthood. It also required put the juvenile court in the position of basically monitoring to make sure that that planning was occurring. And so under the current law, DHS is required to make these plans, and the juvenile court is required to review these plans at permanency hearings. What we did not do in Senate Bill 808 and what has been proposed by the commission, and we agree is an excellent idea, is to also put that requirement at the very tail end of the case so that when the judge is signing the order that permits the child to leave foster care, that once again the court looks at the requirements of Senate Bill 808 for planning and services related to that planning. And then we've added one additional requirement, which is that the court make a finding that as a result of the dismissal of wardship, the child is not likely to become homeless. We think that this will provide, first of all, a higher level of motivation for judges and caseworkers to do what this legislature anticipated they would do with Senate Bill 808 all along the case with teenagers, planning for them and providing them services to assure that they can transition out and be successful, and that it will in that way be able to keep kids from ending up homeless on the street from the foster care system. We are requesting an amendment to clarify our intent with this legislation, and it is attached to my letter. It's a pretty small amendment. It would provide that we apply when DHS is requesting the dismissal. So if a parent or a youth is requesting dismissal, the court does not have to make these findings as to whether DHS has met their requirements for planning and services. We think that about 99% of the time the dismissal is coming at the request of DHS, and it's very infrequently at the request of a parent or a youth, but that it shouldn't be a barrier in those cases. So we would urge passage of this bill and believe that it would benefit children in the foster care system. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I'm sorry. I also handed out, I just wanted to, you got this big package, which I don't expect you to read, but it is, I wanted to let you know that after Senate Bill 808 passed, we worked cooperatively with DHS and with judges to educate them about Senate Bill 808 and about what transition planning for youth needed to include. And this was a training material that we provided in those trainings, and so I just wanted to let you know that we did work to try and get that information out there.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you.
Chair.
Oh, Senator Barr.
Thank you. I'm just kind of curious. I mean, it's the new language here. It says that the Department of Human Service continued and the commitment to the ward. I assume that means the person stays under their foster care or some authority thereof until age of 21. And I find that interesting because I thought in this state, at age of 18, we came a majority.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, it has been the law as long as I can recall that the juvenile court and DHS can keep a child in foster care until the age of 21. The vast majority of children leave either when they hit their 18th birthday or graduate from high school if they're already 18 before they graduate, and that's sort of the kind of unspoken rule. There is a whole group of kids who are developmentally disabled who, under the education system, are allowed to stay in school until they're 21. Therefore, they also are allowed to stay in foster care until they're 21. And there is the flexibility then for other kids as well to stay in after their 18th birthday. But we all know that the rule is that they pretty much leave right around that time, and so we need to work very hard to prepare them, because out in regular families, kids don't actually leave when they're 18. They leave much closer to the age of 23, according to studies that have been done.
Just as a clarification, you say it's an unwritten rule that you are now, you know, keeping kids till 21, even though the law doesn't say it. And what does the law today say?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. The law and Chapter 419, the Juvenile Code, and policy, both DHS policy, provide for kids to stay in foster care until they're 21.
I heard Senator Beyer say the unwritten, whatever it was that many kids leave early, not that they stay late. That they leave when they're early. What happens? Is there any... What happens when a child leaves at 18? I mean, is that against the law if the law says 21? And what's the status of a child who leaves at 18?
Chair Burdick, a child can leave foster care to be emancipated, basically. Of course, a child can always return home. And that happens in very many cases. But a child who is not going to return home, which is kind of the population we're looking at here, can move foster care to live independently. There is no age limit. And we do have...
They could even leave before the age of 18?
Even before 18. We are aware of cases where children leave at 16. 17, 18, you know, there's certainly a group of kids who don't leave until they're 19. So there's a lot of variability in the actual practice. But a child remains in foster care until someone, you know, makes a decision that it's time for that child to leave. And, of course, as we know, children reach the age of majority at 18 years of age, and they are then aware that, you know, legally they don't have to remain in foster care. So many of them are wanting to leave at that stage.
So what the law means is that if they want to remain in foster care and have that kind of support, that they are entitled to that until they're 21?
Chair Burdick, I believe that the law provides that they may stay in care. I'm not entirely clear that they would be entitled to stay. And usually the agency does, you know, if it's a developmentally disabled child, that there's going to be an expectation that they're going to stay until 21. If it's not a developmentally disabled child, they are going to be saying, well, what's happening with this child that they're not moving on to independence? And they may be making certain requirements of that child to, you know, complete high school, to get employment and things like that. But the vast majority do leave right around the age of 18.
Madam Chair?
Senator Beyer.
Does the state continue to pay foster parents for children between the age of 18 and 21?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, a very good question. The state does continue to pay foster parents for as long as the child is officially in foster care. Many children remain in their foster homes after the state has terminated the case, and at that point foster payments are no longer being made. The federal government, which pays a significant portion of the costs of foster care, pays up to the age of 19. After 19, it's completely a state paid for foster care.
And you probably aren't the right person to ask. I'd like to know the numbers of adults who the state is paying for between the ages of 18 and 21 mm-hmm. in foster care.
I'm looking over the list, Senator Beyer. I don't see anybody from DHS on here, but that's a good question, and we can look into it.
Chair Murdoch, I believe it's Kevin George is here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Not listed as DHS. Okay, we'll hear that information then. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you. Okay. Why don't we have Mr. George come on up and Timothy Travis as well. You start, since you got the answer to the question, maybe.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Kevin George, and I am the foster care program manager for the state of Oregon for the Department of Human Services. What's coming around to you is actually some written testimony, and I'll highlight that and not actually read it to you. In essence, at this point in time, the Department of Human Services is here to provide a neutral position on this bill, in that we actually believe it is good public policy to continue to assist these young people in transitioning out of foster care system. We support the fact that last session, Senate Bill 808, did quantify a number of different qualities and critical elements that kids needed to have in order to be able to transition, and one of them being housing that was passed last session. I'm also pleased to note that in the last 2 years, we've actually been able to enhance housing options for adolescents exiting the foster care system through the help of our federal grant called the Chaffee Foster Care Independence Act, which allows us to use the federal funds to do housing services for youth who exit the foster care system after they reach the age of 18. Trying to address Senator Beyer's question, the department at this point in time is anticipating a modest fiscal impact if this bill was to pass based on the cost of foster care for these young adults. And based on the fact that a case that has continued to be open, meaning that the court has continued to find the child under the auspices of the court and assign that custody then to the Department of Human Services, then we also have maintained case management services for that young person. Other services, there likely is still court attorneys appointed for the child, potentially for their parents, given the court. We still go to court hearings and citizen review board. So that's where we believe our fiscal impact might be. As Ms. McFarland attested to, the federal grant, federal funds that we get for foster care, which is Title IV-E, and that's the federal act that we use, provide about 60 cents on the dollar for us to provide foster care services. So for those folks that are 4E eligible, we're able to provide that funding for, and the federal regulation goes to until the child is 18 years old, or if that child is over 18, but are maintaining an education, then we can continue to pay that up until 19. At 19, they're no longer eligible for the federal reimbursement, and then it becomes the state general fund dollars that are paying for those children. The question that was posed was how many of these children are there. I was able to pull some of those numbers for you in anticipation of the question, in that as of last Friday, we are serving 350 youth between the ages of 18 and 21 years old in foster care at this point in time in the department. This is a population, very clearly, that has been creeping up over the last several years for a variety of reasons that have been very appropriately articulated by the other panel members. And it's a population that has been new to us in many ways. It is that 18 to 21-year-old group. And as these kids, young adults, have been able to start turning 18 and 19, Services change, and services are different for what their needs are. And as other folks talk about it, at times when somebody's 18, they may want to vote with their feet, meaning up and leave, and they want to be done with the state system. But the fact of the matter is we're serving that group of kids right now, which constitutes about 5% of our overall foster care population, the 18 to 20-year-old kids now. We believe that It is good practice to continue to support these young people during the transition, because they do not have somebody to go back to for Thanksgiving or to call for help for $20 to do this or that. They need those supports. But the fact of the matter is, if the legislature and the will of this body really believes that we want to expand the role of child welfare in serving this population of children, we clearly need to be identifying the services and the supports that more aptly address their needs than traditional family foster care, because that doesn't meet the need of all these kids as they're 19 and 20 years old. I think it's also important to know that we have an independent living program, which we oftentimes get caught in terminology different. Independent living program for us is skills training for these adolescents, and we can start that as early as 14, trying to teach them things about education and jobs and housing and whatnot. One of the significant barriers for a lot of these young people is the fact of housing. Housing have limitations. In the Northwest, we have a housing crunch. For a landlord to be able to choose to rent an apartment to a young person, they're not inclined to do that. And so we have to be able to bolster our young people up so they can actually be good renters. And one of the things we're finding success in out of the Portland area is a ready-to-rent program, which our young people are able to go through, take some classes on how to be good renters, get an actual certificate, and then be able to take that to a landlord to say, look, I've been able to go through this and made a commitment. Those are the kind of services that really are different than a lot of the young people in foster care that we need to be addressing and looking for. And so this population is new to us. It will certainly increase some of the costs and some of the workloads to the department, and it is about crafting new types of services for them. I am pleased to say, though, that of those children that are involved with our independent living services program, prior to discharge, 44% of our kids are involved up to the discharge date with our independent living services. Of that 44%, 75% of these youth continue on with us on a voluntary basis for 1 to 2 months or up to a year to continue to receive skill training, housing services, or some of the educational things we're able to provide. So several of these children are young adults, kids, can never figure out where to call them. But the fact is that a lot of these young adults are making good decisions, and I think it's important to validate that we have many young people making good decisions for their lives, and as long as they're able to continue to be supported to some degree, all the better for us as a society. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you.
Thank you. So was it the 2003 legislation that allowed the 18 to 20 year old to be stay there, or is that longer than that?
No. Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, the 2003 legislation that we've spoken of was Senate Bill 808, and what that did was that it identified the requirement for the Department of Human Services to develop comprehensive transition plans for youth starting at age 16. And what those plans needed to be, and then the court reviews that, is that when I go into a juvenile court, or used to go into a juvenile court, the judge would ask me, Mr. George, do you have a plan for this young person's education history, their employment, their housing, their community connections and supporting relationships, and their physical health and mental health. So we have to identify those five or six components and prepare a report to the judge about how these are going to play out. The standard for the 8 to 21-year-old is actually listed in ORS 419B-328, and that's actually been there for some period of time. I honestly don't know how long that's been there, but it is about a court's ability to have wardship of a child, and it really talks about the duration, how long they can keep that child, either until it's dismissed or automatically at the age 21.
Thank you. Madam Chair, the kids who are between that age group, if they're still in a foster care situation, does the money paid go directly to the foster parent, or does it start going directly to the child, to the adult, excuse me?
Chair Burdick and Senator Beyer, the payments actually, if the child is still traditionally in a family foster home, meaning there's Mr. and Mrs. Jones are continuing to care for the child, and they're 18 now or 19 now. The monies would go directly to that foster parent. We have been using some programs, and we have one very small program called the Independent Living Subsidy Program, which allows us to provide funds directly to that youth in order to start living independently through semi-supervision as they start gaining their ability to be out on their own.
What happens in the event that the adult is in college and not even living with the foster care provider anymore?
Certainly the question of where, if the child is no longer in the foster home, then there is not a foster care payment. We have a number of youth that we're working with currently that are in college now, thankfully for this legislative assembly who passed a bill two sessions ago to allow a scholarship program for foster care youth, as well as we were able to get a federal grant for scholarships. So some of these young people are actually living in Oregon State, and they actually live there in the dorms. We're able to provide them a scholarship and some housing payments directly to them or directly to the university based on their budget needs. So those youth are not necessarily in a foster home any longer. They're being served under this federal grant in another mechanism.
So in addition to the 350 youth, there's also some 18 to 21-year-olds who are in college who are getting direct payments?
Yes, that would be correct. That's the other group of young people where there's 103 youth that we're serving through our independent living program on a voluntary basis. So total, you're looking at 453 youth over the age of 18, between 18 and 21, that we're serving either through actions of court or on a voluntary basis.
You said 103 are in the college program?
Let me clarify, Senator Burdick. 103 children, or excuse me, young adults are being served voluntarily. That will include those youth that are in college. It also includes those youth that are living out on their own now at 19 or 20 years old, receiving a housing stipend from us, and we require them to continue to go to classes, skills training classes, as they're trying to get out on their own. So that does include that group there. They're on a voluntary basis. If they do not comply with their service agreement that says, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, then they're terminated from that voluntary program.
Further questions, Senator Barr?
I don't think I have. I just thank you for allowing me to ask this question. I find this amazing that we are considering adults, children, and paying for foster care for them. And the number here is really striking. It's about 453, it looks to me like. Some maybe a little less than that because some of us might be under the age of 18 in this voluntary, we'll pay you to be a volunteer arrangement. And I have a bill in another committee which will require when a family member of a child accepts custody of the child that we would pay that family like they're a foster care, because currently if a child is taken from a home and placed with a relative, that relative does not get payment for the child as a foster family. And the number is about 450 youths. That is, we can't afford to pay the family of less than 18-year-olds who are in the ward of the state but living with a relative, but yet we can have money to pay about 450 adults. I find that very striking. And I think we have found a funding source for these families.
And Chair Burnick, if I may, I agree, and I was surprised at the number as well. The fact of the matter is that these youth that are between 18 and 21, the vast majority of that whole program are all federal grant dollars. They're not state general fund dollars. The vast number of those, that other group of folks that you're speaking of, Senator Beyer, is actually state general fund dollars because they're not eligible for the federal grant. So we access and utilize federal grant to the 10th degree here in the state of Oregon, and that's really the difference of those in many, many ways. It's been policy decisions that we as the state of Oregon have made around where we're funding, where we're not funding, and it's a struggle. You're correct.
Well, could you have the number of these 450 some youths they're over then 19, because you said the federal funds are only available to the age 19.
I do have that.
And didn't you say that a lot of these kids at the older ages are developmentally disabled?
Chiburg, Ms. McFarland earlier said that. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are several of these young people that are development disabled, and so they are being served in foster homes for development disability issues. The number you're looking for is the total of all those 18 to 21-year-olds is 350 young adults. 247 of them are 18 years old. So we're talking about roughly 103, if the math is correctly, that are 19 or over. Again, I went to social work school and not statistician, so I think 103 of those young folks then are over 19. And you're correct, after the age of 19, the federal funds stop. I think another provision in the law that I'll be discussing with Ms. McFarland on any amendments is that there is also a statute that allows the department to go after child support of families when children are in foster care. And that statute, too, parallels the federal law in many ways, that we're able to do that up until 18 or up until 19 if they're staying in school. If they're not in school, then we're not able to claim child support any longer on them.
Other questions from the committee? Thank you. Mr. Travis.
I'm Timothy Travis. I'm with the Oregon Judicial Department. In considering this bill, there's a couple things I want us to look at that have nothing to do with these older kids, but have something to do with younger kids. We've come a long way in Oregon since when I started in this business. The sort of watchword around the state was that DHS has no services for anybody over the age of 12. We used to concentrate on the younger kids and really neglect the older kids. Everything that every witness has testified to today about the plight of homeless children in our society is absolutely true and needs to be heard and needs to be said as frequently as possible. These are kids who are behind the eight ball. They don't have a family behind them. They've been abused and neglected. They haven't had that continuous care through childhood that makes them the integrated, happy children that your children are and that my children are. But I want to just kind of focus, if I can, for just a moment on the fact that we usually presume that when we're dismissing a dependency case, we're sending a child home. This is a situation in which we're dismissing a dependency case and we're not sending the child home. Ms. McFarland is right. Kids do leave foster care before they're 18, and there are now judges that are signing dismissal orders for dependency kids who are under the age of 18, younger than 16. But most of those kids have already run away from foster care. They're not sitting in foster care getting transition services, and their cases are being dismissed because they're gone. This legislation allows us to dismiss cases and give the judicial imprimatur, the judicial imprimatur to dismissing cases for kids who are not going home, the issues that brought them into care have not been resolved, they have no parent, no supervision, and no services. These are kids who, as soon as that dismissal order is signed, they are still in a factual situation that a petition as a dependency kid would be valid. There would still be the jurisdictional facts for these children the minute that order is signed. This is, in effect, sort of a streamlined emancipation for kids who are under the age of 18. These children are free to return to the very homes from which we removed them. The amendment that Ms. McFarlane puts forward, and let me just say how hard it is for me to talk like this in regard to something that Ms. McFarlane, my mentor, is putting forward. I wouldn't be the professional I am if I hadn't had her as my mentor. But the Department of Human Services can ask to dismiss a commitment of award over the age of 14 years on a finding that that kid is not going to be homeless. Not a finding that the kid has income. Not finding that the kid is safe. but a finding that the kid will not become homeless. And because of the way that this is written, if the kid or the parent is asking for the dismissal, you don't even need to make this finding. This is the parent from whom the child was removed and to whom the child is not returning. Because if the child was returning home, we wouldn't be doing this stuff. This is a parent who is not qualified to get the kid back, can come in and ask for this dismissal without this finding, or the kid. Now, I have a 14-year-old daughter who believes that I am superfluous, except that I make the house payment. And I have heard it said that probably the greatest substitute in the world for wisdom is being 16 years old. Of course these kids think that they can make it on their own. But that's why we're the grown-ups. We know they can't. I don't want to say that this is a bad bill or that it shouldn't be passed, but I think that maybe we should consider whether or not these provisions apply to kids over the age of 18 and not to kids under the age of 18. Because, yes, we have a lot of kids on the streets of Portland. I used to represent some of them who aged out of foster care. But their dismissal orders weren't signed until they had run away and left the system. So all this concern about homeless kids that we're hearing about is great stuff. And Senate Bill 808 was great. And all the new federal money that's coming in for homeless kids is really great. But I'm concerned, and a couple of the judges that I've talked to are concerned, about cutting kids loose like this with no supervision. So, and since we've got amendments that have not been prepared, I imagine that we're not going to work session today, and I will be pleased to work with the group on trying to kind of iron this out. But I wanted to bring these concerns to the committee.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay. Now we will take Dennis Morrow. And the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition spokesperson, whose name I can't read. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam
Chair, committee members, my name is Dennis Morrow. I'm the Executive Director of Janus Youth Programs, a social service agency in Portland that I'll describe to you, also a parent of a number of kids, many of whom this bill would apply to or could. So I come to you in two roles today. Listening to the struggle, I will have to comment before I go into formal testimony, the struggle of 18 to 21-year-olds. I have to tell you, you're going to hear me loud and clear, they're still our children. They have to belong to somebody. And when they don't, they belong to me running a homeless youth shelter in downtown Portland, and that is a dead-end street for those kids. I also hear seriously the concerns that were raised about the younger children, because we see routinely youth running who have run from DHS custody and care that end up in our homeless youth shelter downtown, sometimes spending the weekend on a cot because there's no place else to put them. So I really don't care what the law ends up being. I care that children are taken care of in the process, and I guess that's my bottom line at this point. I am here today to talk to you about a group of children who we don't want to talk about. Everybody in Oregon has heard something about runaway kids. Most of us have heard or read about homeless youth, often connected with murder on the streets of Portland. We know they're out there, but for the last 20 to 25 years, no one really sees them. I was a part of a group in 1980 that tried to bring a bill to this august body to address the issue of homeless and runaway youth in Oregon, and we couldn't find a sponsor. And we came back in 1990 with a sponsor, and we couldn't get a hearing. Why? Because the children we want to talk about have no voice. Professionals and researchers have even developed a commonly accepted term to describe them. You'll find it throughout the literature about homeless youth. It's called throwaway youth. I'd like you to stop and think about that for a minute. Have you ever heard of disposable infants or garbage children? We never talk about little kids that way, and yet we can take an entire generation of kids and call them simply throwaway youth as a publicly acceptable vehicle to avoid a simple reality. Every year in this state, thousands of children are literally abandoned by their families, and many of those are often then re-abandoned by you and I as people who are working with and for the state trying to protect them.
Mr. Morrow?
Yes.
We have your prepared testimony.
All right.
I was wondering, it's kind of long, so I was wondering if you could summarize.
I would be happy to do that, but I would like to do that in a couple of areas.
Okay.
First to say that Janus as an agency is the runaway and homeless youth entry point for every child that comes into service in downtown Portland and in Multnomah County and in the Tri-County area. We see over 1,000 youth every year. I have over 100 youth every night in shelter. They range in age from as young as age 9 to as old as age 21. The group that we're here to talk about today are talking about homeless youth on the streets of Portland who, as the Citizens Crime Commission has talked to you about, we have seen historically have come out of the child welfare system. These are kids who run away from foster care, many times 15, 20, or 25 times. These are kids for whom traditional services are not working. But these are, and you'll see that message throughout my testimony, these are your children and they're my children. When their families leave them, when their families abandon them, when they are taken away from methamphetamine's homes and come into the custody and care of the state, my belief as a parent is that I expect the state to be responsible, at least as responsible as another family would be for those kids. And to allow them to leave care at 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, or 20 without a hope of survival on the streets of Portland is not anything that you would want for your children or I would want for mine. I would like to highlight one thing. I live this problem at a personal level. My family consists of 8 children. I have 6 of them still at home. 6 of my children have been adopted from the DHS child welfare system, some of them coming to us with early abuse that would really pretty well go beyond the minds of anything that you could even imagine, even as a member of this body. As a parent, I have had to fight with school districts in order to get services for my kids to keep them in school, because I know if they drop out of school, that's the first step to ending up homeless on the street. I see that every day. I have had to fight with DHS to get services for children that were given to me out of DHS custody because they wanted to say, this is no longer our problem, and she no longer rises to the level of severity that she would actually deserve to be in care. As a professional, I've had to watch the collective failure of literally every system, as one of my daughters now is in jail in Calais County as part of the methamphetamine epidemic that you've been reading about in the paper on pretty much a daily basis. She's 20 years old. I adopted her at 17 and a half months out of our state child welfare system. And as much as we tried, I got to tell you, once she turned 18, every system we have in place simply sequentially failed her. That doesn't mean that she was savable, but it does mean we failed her collectively as a society. Basically, we've given up on teenagers, is my view of this. We have seen them as something other than our children. And I'm here today to tell you, as long as we keep doing that, the programs I run for the Oregon Youth Authority that deal with 17 to 20-year-old boys out of the state training school, the programs that you run for older adults who are homeless or on the welfare system or in jail will continue to grow. There's no doubt in our mind, when we look at the system of services in Portland, we have an integrated system of care that can document if a youth is taken into case management in a transitional living program, they have over a 70% success rate at exiting a safe and stable life, or a safe and stable living situation. 70% of the kids that we can work with over time in that 17 to 21-year-old age group can come out with a safe, stable living situation. Almost none of them are going to make it without that help. So this bill, I've just summarized, doesn't ask you to rewrite the Constitution. It asks you to support it by declaring that we are all equal, including youth. The issue is not, do homeless youth need help? The issue is, do we really see them as our children? I'm here today to simply leave you with one question, maybe put in 3 different ways, and that is this. If you or your brother or your sister or your neighbor had a runaway child from home anywhere in Oregon today, and the 1,000 kids that I see every year in homeless youth shelters in downtown Portland, over 50% come from outside of Portland. These are not Portland kids. These are Oregon kids that are coming to us from all over the state. If any of them ran away from home somewhere in Oregon, where would you want them to go? On the streets or to a safe place committed to returning them home? If you found yourself in my position of seeing a child living on the streets, where would you want them to be? Dead or wrapped up in the arms of a caring group of adults trying to nurture them back to life? And if your child or your grandchild's life, through circumstances totally beyond his control, came under the care of the custody of the child welfare system of this state, if you found yourself with your child being cared for by this state, would you even consider an appropriate outcome would be sending that child onto the streets? We have kids who have come to the youth shelter in downtown Portland who have been terminated. Yes, they've been terminated, and their captor care plan has been a bus ticket to the shelter. That happens in Oregon Youth Authority. That happens in DHS. Less so now since we've begun working actively with DHS around this issue, but it is alive and well in Oregon today. So I don't care what law we end up with, and I don't care what language we end up with. This looks to me like about 150 words of law that impacts what we estimate to be 25,000 children in Oregon that are runaway and homeless on any given year. To me, that's a pretty good equation. Thank you.
Especially as a parent of a teenage child, I especially appreciate your comments about not giving up on our teenagers, even though it can be tempting at times. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I'm Jean Lassiter. I'm sorry I didn't print my name so you could read it.
Okay.
I'm here today to represent the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition. And the coalition is a group of providers that have joined together from across the state to address the issues of homeless and runaway youth in the state of Oregon. These are providers, these are agencies, these are community members, parents, and young people who have all come together to advocate for runaway and homeless youth. As you may know, the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition has been working on a statewide evaluation of the status of runaway and homeless care in Oregon, and we have been reporting to the legislature for the past year and a half and the House Human Services Subcommittee most recently. The reason why we have come to the table to support Senate Bill 1034 is that this bill, I think that what I want to say, and I write my notes and then I forget to follow them, but I think that the intentionality of this bill is very critical. I think that what we see when we provide services that are part of systems is that when resources diminish, we lose our ability to connect with each other. We lose the ability to transition our young people and our children from one source of support to another. And so what we see in this bill is an intentional way to address the connectivity of resources between one system and another, and that would be actually three systems. So that would be the courts, that would be the Department of Human Services, and that would be the homeless and runaway youth providers. And four, the young person themselves. I think this is a critical juncture. Oftentimes, young people who have essentially come up in foster care have very intensive and particular needs. If they have been traumatized enough to have been removed from their homes as adolescents, that's one level of distress. An additional level of distress is having come through foster care, foster home, foster home, foster home. And I think that it's easy for us to really underestimate the level of intervention that has to occur in order to provide them with supportive resources. So I think that that's one area that this bill allows us to address. The other and last thing I'd like to say to you about this bill and the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition's support of it is that it's about prevention. And it's about creative thinking. You know, what we've discovered out there in our communities is that if we can work together and we can eliminate the things that create barriers between our systems of care, then we can successfully escort our children and young people into adulthood. If we fail, which we have been failing in for decades, to address the needs of this population, what happens is running away is a coping behavior. Running away isn't just about acting out. Running away is a young person saying to their family and to the world, I'm not doing well here. I'm having a hard time, and I need some help, and I don't know how to manage. And so for me, being somewhere else other than my home seems like a viable solution. But what we know about running away is that if we don't step into it and we don't support that young person, what ends up happening is that running away becomes an entrenched behavior. That running away leads to victimization and may eventually lead to homelessness. And so we're talking about a critical progression in the life of an individual that results in something that we don't want to have happen. So I think that, you know, as you take this under advisement, I think it brings to bear several very thoughtful issues. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay, Ed Johnston.
Good afternoon. My name is Ed Johnston from Lincoln County. Yeah, I do have quite a bit of experience. So listening to some of this testimony really shocks and frustrates me and makes me angry for the misleading statements in some regards. The state is responsible for most of our homeless children in the state. State goes in and takes children out of people's homes for spanking, alleged allegations from a school teacher calling up DHS and said the kid had a scraped knee, it happened at home. I know I've dealt with hundreds of these cases in my county, and it just disturbs me listening to this when the state creates these problems coming back up here to create and more jobs, just justifying more jobs. Now, I know I'll probably get stopped and harassed and more tickets for speaking out again. That happened to me last week, last few days, speaking out last week on bills. I'm used to it after the last 8 years of speaking out, paying a lot for tickets for not deserving it, but it's fine for me to speak out. What frustrates me is listening to part of the testimony. At 5.5 years old, my father and my mother did not work out their differences, so my father left. Okay, at 5.5 years old, this true story, I had my first job in a laundromat. At 7, I was one of the youngest Chevron oil employees at 7 years old. I started paying taxes then. So when they say that this does not work, I mean, it frustrates me. I took the responsibility to help pay my father's way that because of what happened. This is a tall fact. And I went through it with my brothers and sisters with the state of California, where we live, where the state constantly tried to steal us from my mother because my father left. The only reason why we got saved was my grandfather's position as a general manager of San Francisco Water Department and part of the AWA Waterworks Association and retired as president and part of the starter and founder of it. So, I mean, I watched this. I watched the guy right now going through court for spanking his kid. For spanking his child, the state comes in and takes his kid. Okay? I went through another case where three years ago it was, two kids got spanked. The DHS came in and took their kids. The kids kept on running from the foster parents' home. Back home. They kept on being rearrested, hauled back to the foster parent home. They didn't want to be there. This does happen.
Okay, Mr.
40% of our kids are taken this way in this state.
Mr. Johnson, if I can interrupt, this is a little off the subject.
No, but I'm,
and we're running out of
time.
Okay,
thank you. But I just want to make sure that if we're looking at something to protect the kids, as Chair Senator Brader says, we're paying them out for 18 to 21. Now, I can handle paying for somebody when they're special ed disabled or something like that. But I do know cases that they have kept them until they're 21 because they were special ed or because they try to lean to that. And there's cases filed in Lincoln County that have been filed in that manner to get the kids back. It is a very strong concern that we have to look at. Are we defending to save jobs or are we defending to save these children in the right manner?
Thank you. Thank you for testifying. We will now, we're through our witness list, so what I'd like to do is have maybe Ms. McFarland and Mr. Travis kind of put their heads together with Senator Brown and figure out what to do about some of the concerns that were raised in the amendment. Senator Brown is taking a leadership role on this. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1034, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 965. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 965 comes to us from Senator Brown and Senator Johnson. It creates the civil cause of action for invasion of personal privacy. There is a -6 amendment that is before you that replaces prior amendments. There are 1, 2, 3, 4 ways that this tort action can be created. Number one, by defendant knowingly making a visual recording of a plaintiff in a state of nudity without the consent of the plaintiff at a time and in a place where the plaintiff had a reasonable expectation of personal privacy. Number two, if the defendant was in a location to observe the plaintiff in a state of nudity without the consent of the plaintiff and in a time and place where the plaintiff had a reasonable expectation of privacy. Number three, for the purpose of sexual gratification if the defendant knowingly made a visual recording of an intimate area of the plaintiff without the plaintiff's consent or viewed an intimate area of the plaintiff without the plaintiff's consent. And number four in this fourth ground is added by the dash six, by the defendant without the consent of the plaintiff knowingly disseminating a visual recording of the plaintiff in a state of nudity in a place and circumstances where the plaintiff had a reasonable expectation of personal privacy. The cause of action carries with it compensatory damages, liquidated damages, and reasonable attorney's fees. The dash six sets the range of liquidated damage at no less than $1,000 and no more than $5,000. The action must be commenced within 2 years of the conduct that gives rise to the claim, and the effective date of the measure, rather, it would apply to conduct that would apply that occurs after the effective date of the measure, which is January 1st, 2006.
Okay. Thank you. And would you just tell us what liquidated damages are?
Sure. Liquidated damages are those that are set by the legislature in a certain amount or in a certain range for damages that are anticipated to not be such that they're easily ascertained or easily quantified. I did ask Mr. Taylor about this because this was an area that I was not familiar with, and there were a few other examples that he had noted to me. One that sticks out in my head was a cause of action with respect to offensive touching of a sports official. I think that the gist of that, I pictured shoving the ref at a Little League game or something like that, where there's no actual injury, there's no damage, but the legislature deems that to be a civil wrong and is willing to assign a monetary amount, if you will, a civil fine. That's what it is.
But within the context of this bill, it could be something like an unwanted person showing up at your workplace because they saw you on the Internet.
Madam Chair, that is exactly what the additional cause of action in the Dash 6 amendment, the additional ground, I should say, for this cause of action was intended to apply to. That is a circumstance where a defendant disseminates a visual recording of a plaintiff in a state of nudity at a time where the plaintiff had a reasonable expectation of privacy, and in a circumstance where the plaintiff may have consented actually to the recording at the time it was made, but did not and does not consent to the dissemination of that recording. That's exactly what the ground outlined in the Dash 6 was meant to apply to.
Okay, thank you. Senator Pozanski.
I just want to make sure we're on the record on the who is the person that potentially is liable. What I heard the chair say, if someone showed up at your place of business, it's not necessarily that someone who might have observed it, it's the person who actually took the photograph and is now disseminating it.
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, that is correct. The Dash 6 applies to the individual who knowingly disseminates the visual recording.
Okay, are there other questions from the committee? Senator Byer.
Madam Chair, didn't we adopt Dash 5 last time when this bill was in front of us?
You know, I think we were, let's see if we did. Yeah, we had the blanks in it, Senator Byer.
I think we need to go back and check because I thought we actually adopted the Dash 5 and the motion was to send the bill before as amended when I asked about the blanks.
Oh.
That were still in the bill because the Dash 5 didn't address the ones.
What days did we have the hearing? I can look it up.
We had a lot of hearings.
We had a hearing. We had a work session on the 20th.
I think
we made the motion and then you brought up the blanks. And I think that was the end of it. I don't remember withdrawing the motion though.
Madam Chair, for what it's worth, I did not note in my notes that we did adopt any of the prior amendments. I usually do. That doesn't mean we didn't. But
I know we didn't adopt it, but we may not. We may have forgotten to withdraw it.
Oh, here we go.
The motion was not made. It was just talked about, and then Senator Byer noticed.
Okay. So I think we got clear sailing here.
I just found my notes from the 20th. That's Thank you, Senator Walker. Okay. Senator Starr, we have the Dash 6 amendments.
I'm Chair. I move the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 965.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 965. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Starr?
I'm Chair. I move Senate Bill 965 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 965 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Johnson will carry this bill. Okay. Now we will open a work session on Senator Walker's bill. Got too much paper here. Senate Bill 324. Council.
Chairman of the committee, Senate Bill 324 comes to you from Senator Walker. It eliminates the ability of the court to make the terms of settlement a compromise or lawsuit against a government entity, officer, employer, agent of government entity confidential. You have the Dash 2 amendments before you, which I believe Senator Walker worked out with the Department of Justice. Am I correct in that,
You're correct, Mr. Taylor, but I'm going to need Mr. Neely to come up and
talk
about
that. And the Dash 2 amendments in front of you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and if you look at them, what they do is they remove the current provision as it relates to confidentiality, and then on page 1 and the top of page 2 set forth a new requirement, and it's in two parts. The public body, officer, employer, agent of public body may enter into a settlement or compromise that requires the terms or conditions to be confidential if federal law requires terms or conditions of that settlement or compromise to be confidential. Only the terms and conditions that are required to be confidential under federal law may be confidential in the settlement or compromise. And in the subsection B, a court may order the terms and conditions of a settlement or compromise be confidential if, A, the terms or conditions reveal the identity of a person who is a victim of sexual abuse or who is under the age of 18, and B, the court determines by written findings that specific privacy interests of the person outweigh the public's interest in the terms and conditions. Two-part test, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Okay, thank you. Senator Walker, did you want to elaborate? And we got Mr. Neely here in the audience as well.
I do. Mr. Neely, to come forward. Madam Chair, if you recall, just briefly remind the committee why we're here, because of the state hospital sex abuse cases that occurred between 1989 and 1994 and the excellent reporting by Michelle Roberts at the Oregonian. And specifically, there was one particular case, Mary Kay Gonzalez, who was admitted to the hospital in 1989 when she was 12. She was in state care for more than 6 years, and she'd been raped and molested by two employees. She later sued the state of Oregon. The state settled the case after a few days of trial for $300,000, though actually by the time the state paid their attorney's fees, this was the largest settlement ever in the history of the state hospital. It came to $584,809. As part of the additional settlement, the state of Oregon, through the Attorney General's office, authorized another $50,000 to basically silence the woman from telling anyone what happened over there. And there was a transcript in the record that was not supposed to be public, but it got put in the wrong file. And so we learned, and Madam Chair, I'd just like to read this in the record. The Assistant Attorney General at the time told the judge, "We made it clear that we were buying confidentiality from the plaintiffs. The real damage to the defendants is hardly calculable. I don't know how to put a dollar sign on the political aspect. What's somebody going to say in the next legislative session about Dr. Mazur Hart and how he runs his ship out there?" So it was clear they didn't want the legislature to find out what was going on over there, and that's why the bill's here. As we discussed at the last hearing, you raised some issues about confidentiality of children and sex abuse victims and their names, and so reviewing that information. So I worked with Kevin Neely, and we have the Dash 2, but Mr. Neely indicates there may be a small concern on his part, and I'd like him to share that with you, that it doesn't really get what I wanted. What I wanted, Madam Chair, was that the information, there would be no confidentiality agreement, but we would redact names of sex abuse victims, and other information about the file would be available. And I'm not sure we're there. There's some question about that, and I'd like Mr. Neely to elaborate.
Okay, that's in development.
Yeah, I just learned about this, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Neely, with the Department of Justice. In working with Senator Walker on this bill, our intent was to do exactly as she just stated, and that was to ensure that in those cases in which you had a victim of sex abuse or essentially a minor whose privacy rights the judge determined outweighed the importance of releasing this information to the public, the judge could then redact essentially the name and identifying information. The Department of Justice, and again, I would to some extent defer to committee counsel as to a reading on this, but if you look at line 22 on the -2 amendments, they say a court may order that the...
Wait, what page?
Page one. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Page one of the -2 amendments, line 22, says, a court may order that the terms or conditions of a settlement or compromise be confidential if, A, the terms or conditions reveal that the identity of a person is. And I think those are the operative words. It appears to me that this can be read two ways. One is that the entire settlement or compromise would be confidential. That's how I read this. I think it could also be read that just the terms or conditions that reveal an identity of a person who is a victim of sex abuse or who is under 18 years of age, that it could also be read that way. I think we could make this a little bit more clear. Again, as I said, my first reading of this and some of the attorneys at the office recognize that it looks like this would allow the courts to make the entirety of the settlement confidential. Our intent was to ensure that just the identifying information was confidential.
Well, I agree with you. I think it does look as if the whole thing could be made confidential, which is not your intent, Senator Walker.
No, Madam Chair, and I just got these amendments back today and had called Mr. Neely to have him look at these, and
okay.
I did not know this was a problem, and that is my concern is that, you know, we can pass this bill as is and ask them to fix it in the House. I just don't want to be delayed and this bill not go forward, but I also don't like to put out bad legislation.
I would rather get it done right and do our best job before we roll it over to the House.
Madam Chair, I've already spoken to legislative counsel about the concerns. I think there's a very, very, very simple fix, just taking one clause out of Section A and moving it into B here, that will make it crystal clear.
Do you think that could be done by Thursday?
I'm quite confident. Well, I can't speak for legislative counsel,
okay.
But again, I've already spoken.
Madam Chair,
I think it'd be
Senator Byer.
Before you close the work session, I assume that's what you're going to do.
Yes.
I guess I understand where Senator Walker is going on this bill, and I think it's good. But I wonder if anybody's gone back and looked at legislative intent of when this statute was originally passed as is today, because if you look at the statute we have today, I think you'll probably find out the legislative intent at that time was to do exactly what you're trying to do now. And I want you to look at your amendment and tell me, I mean, I'm not aware, but if you look at sub B on the top of page 2 of your amendment, the court determines by written findings that the specific privacy interests of the person outweigh the public interest in the terms or conditions. Does that sound familiar? It should, because look at what's being taken out of the current law. If a court determines by written findings that specific privacy interests of a private individual outweigh the public's interest in the terms, you have got the exact same statute when you finish with this one that you are trying to replace.
Madam Chair and Senator Byer, you're right, and that's why this needs to be fixed, because it's only supposed to take out, redact the name, and nothing else is supposed to be kept confidential. And I did ask legislative history because Dave Hendricks, acting legislative counsel, drafted the legislation, and when I went to him and said, how come the state can enter into these agreements and we can't find out about it? And he opened the statute up and he says, oh, I wrote that, and there's a hole big enough to drive a truck through.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, fix the hole, stop the truck. So that's what we were supposed to do, and that isn't what we got. And so we're going
to
fix it.
But Mr. Neely didn't just speak to sub B. He was speaking to sub A.
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, I think that it's important to note that the court can only do two things. They can only declare, I think, my reading of the amendments here, and again, I'm not an attorney either, so you and I are in the same boat here largely, but I think our intent here, and I do think with one minor change we can make that intent be reflected in these amendments, is only when you have a federal provision requiring confidentiality, or you have a victim of sex abuse, or you have a juvenile, may the court make that determination. So the court has to have the exact same standard as they did in the existing law. However, they can only apply it in those three discrete instances. In the law that stands right now, the court can make that determination in any case for whatever reason. And so, again, instead of having a hole, as Senator Walker described it, that you could drive a truck through, now you can only drive a very small car through it that's the size of these three different, distinct types of settlements.
Well, but the intent of this committee is that when you're redacting information to protect a victim, you're only redacting the information about the victim and not the information about the settlement itself.
Right.
That stays.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate the intent that Senator Walker is trying to get to, but if sub B stays in this amendment, I don't see how it's going to be any different than the current law, because I don't understand where it says that only if it's a minor or the sex abuse or and all three of those cases would apply in the case of the state hospital that Senator Walker's talking about. So,
well, but in that case, isn't it true that, I mean, the circumstances, what happened to these people would still be released, but the people's names would be kept? Council?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm reading for the first time, but the way I read it, the terms of, first you've got subsection A, federal government issue, okay, whether it's money or preemption or whatever, then B, terms and conditions revealing the identity of a person who's a victim of sexual abuse or who's under the age of 18. Then you have to have that, and it would be regardless of what the suit was, where now the judge in any suit could make a determination as it related to anyone. Let's say, for example, you had a lawsuit where someone was suing a landlord because the landlord did not adequately secure the apartment, and you had someone who was attacked, and if that person was abused or under 18, he wouldn't release the person. The intent is not to release the person's name. If a business lawsuit, for example, involving something, a tort action and a products liability action, and the person was over 18, he'd release their name and the terms and conditions of the settlement. That's the way I read it, Madam Chairman. Is that your intent, sir?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's. I'm sorry, Senator Walker.
I just went mm-hmm, and I said correct because we're on the record, and I should know better than to say mm-hmm and uh-uh. So.
Yes, said the court reporter.
Yes, said the court reporter.
Okay, I think what we will do is we will get this done right in accordance with what we have put on the record yet one more time, and get this back to us Thursday and have it sent to the House in good shape.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 324. And we will, while we're at it in this section, we're going to move Senate Bill 881 to Thursday's agenda because we're working on an amendment. And now we will open a related work session on Senate Bill 947. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 947 comes to you from the Judiciary Committee. It requires the Department of Human Services to release records of child abuse to any person who, if the child who is subject to the records dies as a result of abuse, suffers serious physical injury. You had the -3 amendments in front of you, and these were worked out with Tom Gallagher and DHS, Linda Gus, for DHS, and Ms. Swanson, who's here, and Swanson, excuse me. And what you basically have, if you look at the amendments in front of you, and it says, H, any person upon a request of the Department of Human Services reports or records requests regarding an incident in which a child or as a result of abuse dies and suffers serious physical injury. And that's defined. Reports and records pursuant to subsection 1F of this section, the Department of Human Services may exempt
from disclosure the names and addresses or other identity information, identifying information about other children, witnesses, victims, or other persons named in the report or records if the department determines in writing in written findings that the safety or well-being of a person named in the report or record may be jeopardized by disclosure of the names, addresses, or other identifying information, if that the concerns outweighs the public's interest in the disclosure of that information. The balancing test, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Something similar to what we saw on the last bill. And in subsection B, the Department of Human Services does not have a report or record of abuse regarding a child who, as a result of abuse, dies or suffered serious physical injury. The department may disclose that information. This is something that they have, as you can see, it's our dash three amendments, and
right.
They have come to agreement on them.
And the dash three amendments take into account the dash ones and dash twos, replace the dash ones and dash twos.
Madam Chair, members, committee, that's correct.
Okay. Senator Walker.
My notes indicate that you were involved in the work group on this one. Is that correct?
Well, I've been on the fringes of this work group.
Okay.
I was mainly concerned that Mr. Gallagher's concerns get resolved. Mr. Gallagher, would you like to come and give us a nod here?
There are members of the committee, Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers. I'm very happy with the way the Department of Justice and Department of Human Services worked with us to get these amendments, and they are, as counsel explained, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Does anybody have questions for Senator Ringo?
Thank you. How do you know if disclosing the information advances the public interest?
I'm sorry, Senator, I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry. How do you know if disclosing the information advances the public interest?
Senator, that's a common balancing test in the public records law, and the department would make that determination. I'm sure there's a number of factors where they might say, and one we talked about as we put this together was, suppose it was a member of the family that reported the abuse, and that it would damage the relationship inside of that family. That would clearly be a balancing test that would be in favor of the individual as opposed to the general public. So it's a standard that is commonly used in public records. So.
And if someone's unhappy with the where the balancing test comes out, it's appealable to the Department of Justice, is that correct?
That's right, Senator. Yes.
So you
Thank
can
you.
Have a more objective person handling the appeal. Thank you, and thank you for your work on this. Okay, are there other questions from the committee? Senator Stark, we have the dash three amendments.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 947.
Senator Stark has moved the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 947. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Stark.
Move Senate Bill 947 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 947 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, did you have an interest in this? I can't remember whether this is the one.
Absolutely not.
Okay. Senator Walker, did you want to carry this?
Yeah, that's fine, Madam Chair.
All right.
That's two questions. I didn't ask to be curious. I'm not interested.
No, I mean, I actually had thought you were interested in this particular bill early on, so apologize. Okay. Senator Ringo, I think 495 is yours, isn't it? We will now open a work session on Senate Bill 495. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 495 comes to you from this Judiciary Committee, includes the surviving grandchildren and surviving grandparents under Oregon's wrongful death statute. This would allow them the right to sue for wrongful death of their respective grandparent or grandchild.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I was just going to mention to the committee that I've spoken with John Powell, who represents some of the insurance industry, and they do not object to this bill. I'm sorry. I have spoken with John Powell, who represents a number of insurers, and he has said that they do not object to this bill.
Okay. Well, I saw Mr. Powell filtering in and out here, and I presume if he had wanted to say anything, he would have stayed. So appreciate you putting that on the record. We have no amendments, is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Starr, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 495 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 495 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be a no.
Okay. Any other objections? So ordered. You know what? I forgot to take the roll call. Note Senator Beyer as an objection.
No.
Senator Ringo, would you like to carry this? Thank you. Now we will take we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 568.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 568 comes to you from Senator Korzanski. It allows a court to suspend a person's driving privileges for up to 30 days if a person exceeds a speed limit by more than 30 miles an hour. If a person drives 100 miles per hour or greater, requires a court to impose a fine of $1,000, and if the person's and suspend the person's license for no less than 30 days, no more than 90 days.
Okay, thank you. We have the long waiting Dan Swift. My apologies. This has been rolled over a couple of times. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Not a problem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Daniel Swift. I am the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I am here today to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 568 and try to explain to this committee why this law is desperately needed in the state of Oregon, in the opinion of the state troopers that enforce the traffic laws in our state. Under current Oregon law, exceeding a posted speed by 31 miles per hour is simply a Class A traffic violation, which is a fine approximately $400 to $500 depending on the court of jurisdiction when you get stopped. But that's it. There's nothing else. There is no further punishment or deterrent. So if I am a driver on a road with a posted speed of 55 miles per hour and I'm driving at 90 miles per hour, I might just as well do 120 miles per hour because the fine, if I am caught, is identical. Now, I am well aware that in this state, there has been a lot of debate in recent years regarding what the speed limit should be on Oregon's rural interstate highways. And reasonable people can have reasonable discussions all day long as to what a safe and prudent speed is on a wide-open freeway on a clear and dry day. But make no mistake, this discussion today has nothing at all to do with that debate. There is no reasonable person that I know of that is advocating that 100 miles per hour is ever safe or a prudent speed. In addition to my regular duties as a state trooper, I am also an ACTAR certified collision reconstructionist. In fact, I'm one of only 14 state troopers currently holding that certification level within the Department of State Police. This means principally I am a homicide investigator for automobiles. And I understand probably more than most people do the dynamics and physics involved in automobile collisions. Automobiles are governed by the laws of physics. And if you turn to the last page, I've attached a stopping distance chart, which will show you that a vehicle traveling at 100 miles per hour needs over twice as much distance to come to a complete stop as a vehicle traveling 65 miles per hour. A stopping distance chart includes perception reaction time and the actual braking distance it takes to stop the vehicle. Members of this committee, please understand what that means. It means that no matter what danger a driver perceives, another vehicle changing lanes, an animal stepping out into the highway, a pedestrian and a disabled motorist who happens to be trying to cross the freeway to get to a point of safety, whatever the danger is, there is no power on earth that will bring their car to a stop in a shorter distance than the one on the chart. Nothing. I don't think that there's any doubt that exceeding 100 miles per hour is dangerous. The real question is this a problem in this state? The answer, unfortunately, is yes. In 2003, the Oregon State Police cited 533 drivers for traveling 100 miles per hour or greater. In 2004, we cited 509 drivers for traveling 100 miles per hour or greater. And please keep in mind, these stats are for the state police only. They do not include local law enforcement. And these citations were issued in the 2 years following a 25% reduction in the OSP patrol force due to layoffs. When I was working the road myself, I would often sit on the Glen Jackson Bridge between 3 a.m. and 5 a.m. monitoring traffic coming into Oregon from Washington on Interstate 205. On average, I wouldn't go more than 2 weeks without stopping at least one driver for exceeding 100 miles per hour coming into our state crossing that bridge. Basically, automobile technology has outpaced Oregon law. Today's cars are capable of higher and higher speeds. And the cars we're talking about are not professional race cars, which are engineered and designed for high speeds and are operated by trained and experienced drivers. We're talking about young and inexperienced drivers taking their home garage modified high-speed cars out onto the public highways and turning them into their own private racetracks. Unfortunately, the motoring public is also using those same highways under laws and regulations designed for their safe use. And when a vehicle traveling at over 100 miles per hour encounters a vehicle traveling at a normal highway speeds, the end result is what we in the reconstruction community refer to as a non-survivable collision. Just 2 weeks ago, well, 3 weeks ago now, a state trooper in Portland stopped a driver for driving 142 miles per hour on Interstate 205 at 12:30 in the morning. There was considerable media coverage of this event, but one particular theme struck me as very revealing. While I was watching the interview on KATU-TV, did not only with this driver, but his friends as well. First of all of these friends admitted that they also routinely drove over 100 miles per hour. But more important was the opinion, stated on TV and for the record, of one of his buddies, that driving faster than 100 miles per hour was not only not dangerous, but, quote, was only wrong if you get caught. Members of this committee, Oregon now needs to draw a very bright line to make it clear to everyone in the motoring public that's out there that beyond this line, as a motorist on the public's highways, you do not go. This law would draw that line. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to express my appreciation to you for coming to my office and kind of going over the information on your braking chart. And it actually, I think it slowed down my speed on the freeway. I'm not a 100-mile-an-hour driver, I assure you, but I think it did slow me down significantly after we talked, so I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Senator.
I did actually contemplate when I thought of this bill, you know, you set that bright line at 100 miles an hour, and I'm just wondering why you set it to that, because it seems like if you went 90 miles an hour, that's close to being as bad, and I'm just wondering how you picked 100. Was it just a nice round number?
Well, I'm not advocating that 90 miles per hour can be safe either. It's in many ways just as dangerous. However, you know, you got to pick a line somewhere, and I don't think anybody agrees that triple digits is a safe speed on an interstate freeway or a rural highway or anywhere else, and it's just kind of an arbitrary number. But I think that that's a very easy number for everybody to remember, and that's kind of why we picked it as deciding it's particularly dangerous. We got to draw a line somewhere, and I think that's a very clean and simple demarcation line that everybody can recognize.
Okay, thank you. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Brunick. Officer Swift, this bill requires the court to impose a fine and suspend a licensure or. Can you envision any emergency condition where citizens might be justified in traveling in excess of 100 miles per hour in a automobile equipped for that speed on a freeway, under freeway conditions?
Any emergency conditions? No, sir. Even if it's a medical emergency, that's what ambulances and Life Flight is for. If conditions are clear and dry, then Life Flight can usually get there faster than the person can, or another emergency vehicle. We are also, all state troopers are certified first responders. Now, there are emergency situations out there, and I understand that, but there's also public help that's available a lot faster and a lot safer than traveling at over 100 miles an hour if you're trying to take someone to a hospital or something. Because as we try to teach all of our drivers, new state troopers, new police officers, when they're teaching them the emergency vehicle operations course and how to operate a vehicle at high speeds, and we do a lot of extensive training in how to train our officers how to operate at high speeds, the most important rule you have to remember is if you do not, whatever the emergency is, if I run into somebody or crash and I don't arrive, then I don't do anybody any good. So the whole purpose is it's better to arrive there, in essence, 2 minutes later and arrive than try to save 2 minutes and never get there at all. And so the answer to your question is, sir, is no, sir, I don't.
Follow up, please.
Please follow up.
Chair Brick, that depends on whether you're bleeding to death or not. Would it surprise you to know that in eastern Oregon it isn't uncommon to have as much as 45 minutes response time by an Oregon State Police officer, sometimes longer than that?
No, sir. That wouldn't surprise me at all, considering we don't have any 24-hour operations anywhere in the state. That does not shock me. No, sir.
So your response a few moments ago about response time and how it would be quicker to actually get a state police officer to help you or an ambulance to help you might not be completely accurate in given Eastern Oregon and, say, around Bly or Wagon Tire or Denial or someplace like that.
Well, I'm referring to the full emergency medical services, including fire departments, sir. You're asking me my opinion, and my opinion is I can't really think of anything that would endanger everybody else at that particular speed.
I'm sure. I appreciate your opinion.
Senator Brzezinski.
I'll just put on the record that if someone found themselves in that situation, Senator Wissett, there would be the ability for them to feed to the court choice of evils defense. Basically, that it was reasonable under the circumstances to break one law for the betterment of something else. That would be something that someone could raise. Would it be successful? Would be up to the judge under the circumstances and the situation whether they met the criteria. But there is that on the books.
Also, sir, if I could have a follow-up answer as well. I have stopped people that have had medical emergencies, legitimate ones, such as a heart attack, giving birth, that kind of stuff. I have not issued a traffic citation in that particular case. I've instead rendered medical aid. But I have stopped them from doing the speed they were doing, but I have not been taking enforcement action on them, and that falls under officer discretion to issue or not issue.
I'm more concerned about the letter of the law than I am the intent of the law. If I may, Senator Brzezinski, are you comfortable that even though this requires the court to sanction a person in a certain way, that defense that you offered would still mitigate the circumstance?
I am. The way it would work is they would raise the defense in the case in chief and in the actual case to determine whether or not they're guilty. What would happen is the judge would find them not guilty based on the choice of evils defense. And if the court found them not guilty because of that, relying on that, you would not go to sentencing. If the court denied that defense, either they didn't meet the criteria or the court deemed that it wasn't appropriate for that case, then the court would be bound by what's required if someone was found to be in violation of the speed of 100 miles an hour or greater.
That's why you're a lawyer and I'm not. Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Other person, Senator Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Richard brings up a good point, and I can put a name and a face to it. Last fall, Matt Harper, Steve Harper's son, was when he was shot. I don't know if they were traveling at in excess of 100 miles an hour, but they were out in rural Klamath County, and they had a tourniquet on his arm, trying to save his arm and his life, and they were speeding down the highway while the one person, the passengers, in contact with emergency services on the cell phone, and they rendezvoused with an ambulance, but they almost got to Klamath Falls prior to the ambulance getting out of Klamath Falls. And, I mean, bleeding to death, life-threatening emergency, this is a name and a face in that exact situation.
And if I could.
Please.
And I would assume that if an officer, which I would be very surprised any officer would actually give a citation, but if they did, if that individual who was driving went in with those circumstances, just from what I know as to what the law provides for, they would have met the criteria for violating the speed limit, and I'd be amazed if a court would not find them not guilty for that reason. But yeah, I mean, it definitely can happen, and that's the reality, the balancing as to, and that's why we have this kind of a catch-all defense that does allow for, and it can be not only in motor vehicle traffic rules, it can be in other criminal cases as well.
Trespass
would be a wonderful one in that case, let's say, where they needed to get someone across the property to a roadway, and someone tried to bring those type of criminal charges against them for illegal entry and staying on the property. That would be an excellent, example of how it could be used in a criminal setting.
And, Senator Byer, again, if I may, if that were coming in and I were on patrol and that were dispatched out there, I'd be looking for that vehicle to render medical aid, not to make an enforcement contact, probably put the person into my car if I'm closest, and then use my lights and siren and driving skills to get them to the hospital using medical aid. But again, I'm not out there. We're not out there to enforce this on medical aids. That's legitimate. Our first concern becomes public safety and saving lives. not trying to write a ticket out of it, believe me.
Senator Starr?
I'd like to put another face on this. 20 years ago, two of my sons moved to Beehive at dark, south of Hillsboro, 4.5 miles. Son got stung in his armpit. 30 minutes later, he went into anaphylactic shock. Fortunately, the other boy had carried him downstairs before he passed out. As he passed out, he had collapsed on the floor, and his departing words were, "It's all over." I said to the wife and son, "It's not over. West, you start the car. Kathy, call the hospital and tell the emergency that we'll be there in a few minutes." I carried him to the car, and it was running when I got there with him. Set him in the seat, told West to sit behind him and hold him upright. West later said, "Dad, I didn't know that Volkswagen bug would go 85 miles an hour in second gear." If the road had been straighter, it might have gone faster. But before I got into town, I caught up to a county sheriff. Being dark, not wanting to run over a sheriff, I flashed my lights on and off and caused him to pull over. I pulled alongside and said, "We have an emergency, shock patient unconscious." The officer didn't hesitate. He said, "You know the way?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Follow me." And when I got to the hospital, he opened the door and I lifted my son out, carried him in, and 30 minutes later, the doctor said, "It was that close. We don't save many who have gone that far." He had 3 shots of adrenaline before he recovered, and I never saw anybody jump on it lying flat on their back like he did. But thankfully, we were there, and we took emergency action that was necessary. We could not have waited even to transfer him from one vehicle to another. But I understand that this law is not for that kind of case. It's for those who speed for the joy of driving at high rates of speed, and I think that's not appropriate. I would feel a little more comfortable if the judge was offered it within the legislation some discretion rather than making the defense.
Madam Chair, we actually have, when you look at it, if it's within that 30 mile, if it's over 30 miles an hour, let's say if it was on a roadway of 55 and someone was doing over 30 miles an hour, it is discretionary. It's when they hit 100 or more that it's not. We're trying to give discretion and trying to give that option, but in my discussions with the state police, and I came to the same conclusion for, I think, many of the reasons that they've articulated today, that we have to draw a line somewhere, and at that point, if they're in violation of in the triple digits, they got to get a lesson, they got to learn, or we're going to have people dying because of those results.
Madam Chair, I mean, you can argue that for emergency purposes we ought to allow people to run through stop signs or stop lights or violate all sorts of traffic laws, and I think rather than putting in the code specifically that is covered in the choice of evils defense, and certainly one approach to, I think these are very legitimate concerns, one approach would be to create a specific exception for emergencies, but then we have to do it everywhere. And I think that it is implicit in that defense.
Well, if we listed as an affirmative defense that it was a medical, life-threatening emergency.
Well, but that should be a defense for violating any traffic law, as far as I'm concerned. If you have a legitimate emergency, mm-hmm. you have a defense.
If I could just maybe put on the record what the choice of evils defense. 161-200 is the citation for choice of evils, and I'll just drop down where it says the conduct is necessary as an emergency measure to avoid the imminent public or private injury, and the threatened injury is of such gravity that according to the ordinary standards of intelligence and morality, the desirability and urgency of avoiding the injury clearly outweighs the desirability of avoiding the injury sought to be prevented by the statute that's basically being violated. So I would tell this committee that we already have that built in, and there's no reason, I think if LC was here, they would encourage us not to be adding these type of additions to each and every bill that goes through that has potential penalty sanctions and rely on the 161-200 that's a catch-all for all.
Also, members of the committee, if I may, and I agree, people have to do when their loved ones are in danger. They have to do what's right. I mean, they really do. None of this, anywhere in this law, mandates an officer take enforcement action of any kind whatsoever. So, first of all, you have the officer's discretion. That has never been taken away by this law. We're not mandated to issue a citation. The second thing, if for some reason the officer feels that it is dangerous and it's not justified, the second fail-safe is in the redress through the court system, through the judicial system. So none of this is mandating that an officer encountering this, we're not required to issue citations. And, you know, do I think 100 is safe? No, it's not. But do people do what they got to do? Yeah. And do I have to weigh those balances of the lesser of two evils? Yeah, we have to make that decision every day out there. So I don't, you know, this doesn't take our discretion away. We're reasonable people, and we're out there to protect the public, including the, you know, the medical emergencies. So I think that this law will work. I really do.
Thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 568. Senator Starr, did you want to wait
yes.
on this? Do you want to wait on this?
Let's move it.
Okay. Open a work session on Senate Bill 568.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 568 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 568 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Byer?
Madam Chair, thank you. I don't mind sub 5 and new sub 5 in this bill. I think 100 miles an hour is a line that should be drawn. The part that got my attention was the sub 4, the 30 miles an hour or greater. In most of Oregon, that's 85 miles an hour. I recognize the people driving down the interstate. But in most of Oregon, that's 85 miles an hour. And if you were to check the speed on the interstate, it's probably averages many places near 85 miles an hour. If you get out into eastern Oregon, the speed limits out there are 55 miles an hour. And by law, they can't be higher than that. We've got probably better roads and better driving conditions out there to do 85 miles an hour than we do on Interstate 5 or Interstate 84. I have a problem with that part of this bill. If you get caught going, there's reckless driving and things like that can be charged besides speeding, isn't there?
Depends on what the circumstances are, but I mean, if someone's doing triple digits, I would say that would be considered reckless.
I agree with you. Of the sub 5, I agree with the 100 miles an hour part of the bill.
But below that, it's going to be discretion as to what the officer observes in the conduct of the individual as to what they're doing. I would point out that is not a required suspension. And what I would expect that I've seen, at least from what the courts have said, is that you have X number of speeding tickets, moving violation tickets, and I wish I could, but I can't. And so where I expect this to be utilized is where individuals have had some type of history of violating speeding laws, and the judge is going to have the opportunity, if he or she believes it is appropriate. Would it be used on the first time? It could be. But I would expect that the majority of the cases, it's not going to be on the first time, but unless there's something that's insinuating based on the observations of how they're driving. But then they're probably going to have careless driving, at least, which is another violation, or possibly reckless if it was actually putting people at risk. And so, you know, the way this has been drafted is more in concern is giving, quote unquote, another tool for the judge who believes in the appropriate case. It would be good.
In the words of Senator Ringo, how about on a second violation or language like that, give somebody one bite of the apple. I'm going to vote against it today. I got a funny feeling that, you know, I always said every session that my wife gets one vote, and that may be her bill, because I know she feels about speaking.
But I'm going to vote against it today.
All right.
I will vote for this bill today, but I will reserve the right to vote no on the floor.
I appreciate your giving us heads up. Thank you.
Okay.
Senator Starr he's made the motion already, right?
That's right.
Has made the motion to pass Senate Bill 568 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? Any objection? Senator Beyer objects. No one else. So ordered. Senator Kosansky, you can carry this bill. Senate Judiciary is adjourned.